Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
I've had a lot of coffee, thanks to you. You got me a little coffee. I'm a lovely little coffee. Shout out to Good Brews in Gateshead in the Northeast for their fine brews of a morning.
More like Great's Head, because they're great.
Oh, no. It's mostly just a comment on the state of Gateshead. Also, shout out to anyone who lives in Gateshead. What Culture HQ is based in Gateshead. But I don't think anyone's ever referred to Gateshead as Great's Head. It's never really earned it.
It's a first time for me as well.
Yeah. There's a lot of police presence around the station this morning when we were coming in. But this is the Untitled Banter Podcast, the UBP, the UNBP, yet again, because Jules Gill constantly doing a business. He's either doing a business or he's off or he's doing whatever, but it doesn't matter because we're having a lovely time anyway. Ewan, how are you feeling?
I'm doing great. I hope I'm not becoming one of those sitcom replacement characters that everyone gets sick of after a while.
No, I think you're the one that like comes in and actually is one of the best possible replacements you
can
have.
Woody Harrelson in Cheers.
Yes, I've not actually watched, I'm admitting this on air, but I've barely watched
it. I mean, to be fair, it's very before both our times. The only reason that I've seen bits of it is because spiritually I have the soul of a 75-year-old man. So that's the reason why I'm aware of Cheers.
I remember watching little bits of Cheers because it was always mentioned as like the progenitor of Friends or the modern sitcom or whatever. So I did bits and pieces of it, but I've not seen that much of it. Anyway, the Untitled Banter Podcast is where we take on people's questions, talking points, etc. However, because we're recording a day in advance, I just thought, why not go back into what Jules Gill once called the take trough to retrieve some questions and talking points because we always get so many through anyway. And I would rather try and get to as many submissions that people have sent across regardless. So a question from Jack Asbury, and some of these are from last week, some of them are from previous weeks. I thought, why not do a bit of a roundup? Question from Jack Asbury, who says, question for you, and why is Avengers Earth's Mightiest Heroes the low-key best Marvel cartoon?
I mean, for the first off, it has like probably the third best intro for like a Marvel show.
I've never even heard of this thing.
So you have like, obviously you have X-Men, which is like...
Yeah, the riff, yeah.
And then obviously you have the 90s Spider-Man show, which is like, you know...
I can't remember
Spider-Blood, Spider-Blood, radioactive Spider-Blood.
Bring back guitar riff intros, like where'd they go?
They're both great. Mm-hmm. on the bottom rung, you have the Fantastic Four animated series intro, which if I speak aloud, will act like a mind virus and everyone will get it stuck in their brains.
I don't think I ever watched that.
There's no need to be there here, just call the bomb.
Sadly, I don't even... I mean, that's awesome, but I have no...
It's from the same era. You had that, like you had Iron Man, you had Hulk. The Hulk one was pretty good inspired. But anyway, Avengers Earth's Mightiest Hero came out like the late 2000s and it had this really, like, really... badass intro. It's like, the world's about to break. It's a really fun show for what it was. It's not like the peak of like my 90s Marvel love or like the early 2000s, because X-Men Evolution for me is like really underrated as a cartoon series.
You were able to keep going. I had the Spider-Man Fox show, the X-Men show.
Bear in mind that I am like 7 years younger than you.
True, so. But for me, I watched those in the 90s and then that was it. I'd never even heard of this Avengers one and I didn't keep going for the other Spider-Man.
The Avengers one, this is very late. This is like late 2000s But yeah, no, it's a good show. I mean, if you're into that sort of thing, like it's pretty inoffensively charming. There are some fun deep comic book pulls. Never reaches the heights of like the older stuff, but yeah, right. it's a fun time.
I want to break some minds. My introduction to the Justice League was I think they're called the Super Friends on Dexter's Lab.
Oh, damn.
Yeah. I didn't even know what the Justice League was. I was just like, oh, it's like, they're like them.
So, you, Scott Telford, you like Batman animated series, don't you?
I love Batman animated series.
You like, did you watch Batman Beyond?
No.
Did you watch Superman?
Well, I saw little bits and pieces of Batman Beyond, but when I was young, I was like, this isn't my Batman, this isn't for me.
Just the same people who made it.
Young me was like, it's not Batman, though. Like, it's a different look,
isn't he? Oh, you fool. You fool. Batman Beyond is like the story.
You fool.
Like, Batman, like, honestly, mate, if you love to revisit Batman animated series, and this goes to anyone listening right now, if you love Batman animated series and venerate that series very highly.
It's on Netflix now, by the way.
Just treat yourself. Mm-hmm. Go watch Superman, the animated series, which is done by the same creative team of Bruce Timm, Paul Dini, Alan mm-hmm. Burnett, etc. Watch Batman Beyond because it is the coolest, most metal, cyber goth, like punk stuff ever. And I love that series to pieces.
You won me with the word cyber goth.
It's got the best, like, intro to a superhero. Like we know, like, Batman Animated Series is a great intro, whatever. Mm-hmm. The Batman Beyond intro, which is storyboarded by the late, great Darwin Cook, who's one of my favorite comic book artists of all time, storytellers in general, is just brilliant. And then that feeds into the Justice League series, which is kind of where, obviously the Static Shock as well, which kind of came out around that time, which is all set in the same universe, DC Animated Universe. Justice League and Justice League Unlimited, the stuff that they achieve in that show is just as good as what they do with BTAS, and it kind of represents a storytelling high point for the DCAU project as a whole. DC, as an entity to me, has never been better than those Justice League cartoons from the early 2000s.
Okay.
They do a really intricate, multi-season long arc called the Cadmus arc, and it dives into, like, kind of like almost like Watchmen-inspired discussions of, like, superhero dumb and fear and, like, you know, gods and monsters and all that sort of stuff. And it's just the stuff they achieve with that, the character arcs, the introductions you get to obscure DC heroes, which have informed my tastes in comics for years now. I always gravitate towards those, like, Silver Age, Golden Age obscure characters because of this show.
Yeah.
Honestly, I would fully recommend you go check that out because it is genius.
You've massively sold me on Batman Beyond. I mean, I know what Batman Beyond is, and I've always seen the skins, and I've seen bits and pieces of when that show was originally on. But at the time, like I said, young me was just like the original one. But I remember finding out years later that it was Kevin Conroy as old Bruce Willis, I was going to call him there.
Bruce Wayne.
Yeah. So, I like the idea of that. To be honest, I'm now thinking of places I can get a Batman Beyond box set from.
Yeah, you mean you can get... I got the Blu-ray the other year. It's a great set. The only thing I would say is it comes with Return of the Joker, which is my favorite Batman movie, full stop. Mm-hmm. I love that movie. It is brilliant. Mm-hmm. That feeds into Batman Animated Series too. The only thing I will say with that is that the one that they packaged with, at least the UK edition, is the censored version.
Huh.
You want the uncensored version.
What's uncensored of it?
Well, they censor out all the blood. It's very dark. It's very, very dark. They get rid of all the blood, and there's a thing that happens with Joker that I won't spoil, which is completely changed in the censored version as well. Right. So if you can just track down, there's an uncensored DVD, which is multi-region, which you can probably get, but it's fully worth it.
Shout out to that entire era. Like, my wife hadn't seen Mask of the Phantasm until like last year, so I was like, we need to sit down and watch Mask of the Phantasm.
If you love Mask of the Phantasm, you will love this, and you will love the Batman Superman World's Finest movie, which is another one they did, which was a crossover between Superman and Batman, and to this day it has my favorite meeting of Superman and Batman where they both uncover each other's identities. I'm getting goosebumps, man. Sorry, it's cool. This become the DCAU variety.
I mean, I'm not a big Superman fan. I kind of realized, like, over how much DC's pushing. I mean, we'll get to video game stuff. We have lots of questions and things. But in regards to Superman, I just have a gut feeling that Superman ain't it.
No, right. This is the thing. I'm going to turn you around on this now, Scott. I think the reason why you think that is because the way Superman has been presented to us over the past 20 years has been a fundamental misrepresentation of what is good about the character.
I did love the sitcom show that was on in the 90s.
Oh, Lois and Clark.
Yeah, no, maybe. I think it was
Smallville as well.
It was the one that was before Smallville.
Yeah, so Lois and Clark.
I think maybe Lois and Clark, yeah.
That, like, that kind of spirit is more in tune with what we're after. What they do in the DCAU is what Superman is to me, where they don't try and make him dark and edge. They don't give him, like, the whole badass red eye thing. There's no kind of like, oh, Superman's only interesting if he's evil or whatever. They really get to the core of what makes that character compelling. They add more vulnerability to him. They don't make him, and which is kind of the same evolution he overtook in the comics, where you have John Byrne come in and write the character in the 80s and 90s, and really kind of with the Man of Steel books basically gives us the definitive, what is to me the definitive incarnation of Superman. So honestly, I know it's very difficult. Superman is a tough sell to this kind of very cynical modern era that we're in, but that is why he is so compelling to me, is that he kind of stands against that, and it's not always all truth, justice, the American way. It's, you know how people saw Captain America before, like, yeah, he was, yeah, like, introduced in a way? It's a similar thing to that. That earnestness stands as a nice uplifting contrast, but there's also moments of darkness, and there's also moments of great cosmic stuff where they layer in what Jack Kirby did with Darkseid and the Fourth World and everything. Dude, honestly, I... Give Superman the Animated Series a go. Uh-huh. Probably give Batman Beyond a go first.
I'm going to do Batman Beyond, yeah.
But Superman the Animated Series is great too.
Okay. You mentioning Cap, and we'll totally get to game stuff soon, but the way they presented Captain America across the MCU, when you look back on it, does feel like this, you like tap danced over a few laser beams and nailed this kind of thing. Like, I love his whole motivation. I love the deconstruction of why he is Captain America. They did such a good dissection of that stuff in the first movie, and then like kind of picking it apart a bit more in Civil War as well. I miss that era. I miss when we had faith in all that stuff.
Yeah.
That was a lovely time to experience in real time. But yeah, getting through more people's questions. Did we even answer that one? Yes, we did.
Yeah.
Question from Jim Donaldson, who says, gents, what old school gaming habit do you still do to this day? Even now, I'll keep 3 manual saves on the go, overriding the oldest after each session. I'll back that. I don't trust autosaves. I've mentioned it many times before, maybe even to you, but I don't trust autosaves at all. Baldur's Gate 3, just finished it last night. I'll always override my autosave with an actual save, even though it's the same thing.
Yeah, I think that's smart practice in general. I remember when I was reviewing Marvel's Midnight Suns for old workplace last year, I literally had an issue where whenever I tried to overwrite a save, it would just crash and I'd lose progress on the overwritten save as well. So that sucked a lot. Backup saves, that's just a smart pragmatic thing to do, unless they don't give you the option, in which case you're kind of hinging your enjoyment on the autosave spinning rectangle of doom.
I feel like in terms of old school gaming habits, I guess they've become habits, but it's like, it's buying physical, it's reading the instruction manual on the way home, if there even is one. Hardly any games ever do, but that's why I love a good steelbook and a nice collector's edition.
Yeah, there's never really I remember, like, this is such like a, you know, like a childhood experience, like, you know, getting a game and then rigorously going through the instruction manual,
yeah,
but also looking at the back of the box and like looking at the things. Now if you look at the back of a box, like an even like a massive AAA game, there's nothing. There's like, continue the adventures of blah. There's like three screenshots, if that.
And a quote saying, like, one of the games of the year.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I don't really have old gaming habits. I mean, I'm still, this is going to, anyone who's like a posturist is going to be like crying.
What's a posturist?
There's someone who, like, you know, looks at people's posture and stuff.
Oh, okay.
Like, I sit on the floor and play games still, which at the age of 27 makes me look like a gigantic child.
Hey, if you're happy, that's lovely.
But, you know, that's probably my oldest gaming habit, is that I still prefer to play games on the floor.
That's fun. See, when there was that spate of mini consoles a few years ago, it was like the mini NES, mini SNES, mini Mega Drive, mini PlayStation. All of them I played on the floor, but that was mainly because the controller lengths weren't long enough to be able to sit back on the couch. But when I got my N64 for my 30th birthday, I bought a controller extending thing so I could play that on the couch across the living room. But there's something about gaming on the floor, man, especially with friends. Like,
especially
when, I have a friend early,
when you have like a drink to your right, a bowl of snacks to your left.
I feel like that, the whole snack gaming thing, is one of the biggest myths in gaming.
Because you can't, you need to like have the hand sanitizer on the go, man.
Yeah, the sanitizer. So I like, one of my life hacks is taking like a lemon wipe into the room where I'm going to have the finger food. Then I don't have to get up and go and wash the hands. I can lemon wipe it.
You just get the restaurant experience, get a little finger bowl.
Yeah. It literally was inspired by KFC. Like, you get those little hand wipes. I'm like, let me just leave that.
I mean, like a restaurant where you get the little bowl to dip your hands in after you like peel in prawns. A or lemon slice. Man. I mean, the thing that would complete that for me, little blankie.
Right.
Just to go over you, keep you nice and
snug. Especially this time of year, like
peak cozy core.
Yeah, bit of the old cozy core. 2 a.m. Baldur's Gate with a bowl of snacks.
That's too late. It's past my bedtime.
that's when I come alive. A question from Travis Nichols, who says, "Quick, what was your favorite video game startup cinematic? You know, the one that plays every time you boot up the game." They'll go first. The Punisher on PlayStation 2. I know exactly what mine is. It's Onimusha 3. I don't know if you played Onimusha 3.
No, I haven't.
If I watch Batman Beyond, you should watch the intro to Onimusha 3.
I don't know why it took me so long to answer that. I've literally think I've heard that word 3 times before in my life.
Oh my God, the Onimusha series is so stupidly overlooked. I'm still hoping that it's coming back because you've got the Netflix anime. There's the remaster of the first Onimusha that they put out, I think, last year or the year before. It seems like Capcom want to do something with it again. The Onimusha series, though, is... I was going to swear they're effing awesome. But Onimusha 3, for like 2004 or whatever it was, has this mind-blowing opening CG thing where you're following the dude, Samanosuke. He's like this warrior and he's going up against this big like beast army. But all the choreography and the fights is all done proper hand-to-hand combat, martial arts stuff.
Oh,
it's so effing cool that they've never topped it. And the game itself, you can argue, didn't top it either. But the opening for that game is hands down at least my favorite opening cinematic ever.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to have to go through for an old school pick here again and go Marvel Ultimate Alliance because Blur Studios, they got their start with the... I want to say like within the gaming space, I recognize them because they were brought on for... X-Men Legends 2, mm-hmm. which had like really nice Blur-constructed cinematics. Mm-hmm. Then Marvel Ultimate Alliance, the intro of that where it's just Captain America, Thor, Spidey, and Wolverine beaming on the helicarrier.
That bit.
With Nick Fury and Doctor Doom, and like they're all like destroying the different like mm-hmm. bots and stuff. That is such a cool way to introduce you to the upscale of everything.
That bit, because they cast Cam Clark, Liquid Snake, as Thor, and the bit when he flies up and he cuts that machine in half and he's like, soulless machine. Like,
how dare you strike the son of Odin?
Yes, exactly.
That's terrible. I know all the dialogue there.
No, no, it's great. That was, oh
is
my God.
Is this the fairy to Staten Island?
Ultimate Alliance absolutely ruled. Because they can't even buy them anymore. Like they remastered them and then they delisted them again.
Was thankfully there to get it.
Right.
So it's there on my PlayStation, but I also have it for 360 and I'll probably buy it again and again and again.
Where did you come down super quick on the Ultimate Alliance 1 versus 2 split?
1. I mean, that's got to be 1. 2, yeah. two was, wasn't Raven, it was Treyarch. Mm. And they messed with too much. They didn't really keep the soul of the original game. I don't care for Civil War as a comic either, so get that out of there for me. Mm-hmm. I mean, I will say I think X-Men Legends 1 and 2 are better than Ultimate Alliance. I love Ultimate Alliance, but I just love being in the X-Men space specifically. And I'm such a finicky Marvel fan that like the idea of like bringing Daredevil, even though he's my favorite Marvel character, to a place like Asgard and he's just not got any like special power. I'm in my head, I'm like, that doesn't make any sense whatsoever. So I'm just happy to have my little X-Men team, to be honest.
Yeah, I would back Ultimate Alliance 1 as well. I remember going back to 2 a few years later to try again and get through it. It's fine. It looks better, like graphically, but it doesn't.
Graphically, care, do you? Yeah, it's a shame that we didn't. Activision have crimes to answer for. So many crimes, way worse than what they did with Marvel. But you know what I mean.
Did you get around to Ultimate Alliance 3, the Switch one?
No, I don't have a Switch.
No, but I was wondering if you saw it or whatever, because it's such a different game.
We played a couple games at the old office. Yeah. I recall.
It's a weird thing. Every single time my brain will not clarify whether it's Ninja Theory or Team Ninja, but it's one of them. I think it was Ninja Theory, the one that isn't the Hellblade devs, and it's the Ninja Gaiden lot who came in and did Ultimate Alliance 3, so it's way more melee focused and combo focused and like grinding for items to craft focused, and it was just like, what even is this anymore?
It's just ridiculous to me as well that they make a Marvel Ultimate Alliance sequel, like one of the most anticipated Marvel licenses ever is this Switch exclusive. Yeah. Like, not the Switch or anything, but like that should be getting the AAA experience. It's annoying that we've not had any of those kind of, apart from like Diablo is the one that started it all and is the one that has remained. Like it's really annoying that we haven't had any like Diablo-esque superhero RPGs.
No,
since,
actually. I mean, if you give it a long enough timeline, you would assume that someone... I mean, my head just goes to Larian because they did Baldur's Gate, but imagine a Baldur's Gate level of depth with the MCU or like Ultimate Alliance or whatever. That could be cool. But yeah, like that whole Switch exclusive thing still makes less sense the more time has passed. Like there's not even a version of that available anywhere else. Question from Dustin, who says, as a longtime PlayStation connoisseur, I'm wondering if y'all believe Xbox has done enough to get PlayStation users to buy an Xbox console this holiday season. Seems like waiting for the rumored updated consoles next year is the way to go. This is fascinating because I don't know if you've kept up with I feel like 5 people on earth keep up with console sales, but have you seen the Xbox sales statistics at the minute?
I saw that they did really badly in Japan recently.
So they sold it, it's literally almost 1/100 of what the PS5 sold in Japan. It was 102,000 PS5s and like 2,000 Xboxes were sold, and that's combined Series X and S. More recently, the Europe's statistics have came out. I don't have those numbers to hand, but Xbox is very much behind the PlayStation and Nintendo. Although Nintendo's also dropped off. It was like 20% down from last year.
But mate, they have the Wonka console now.
They do. They have a Bluey console as well. I think tapping into markets that I've barely heard of.
The Wonka console is going to save Xbox.
There's not a Wonka. There's not a chocolate. How is there not a chocolate like a Factorio style Willy Wonka Chocolate Factory management game? How does that not exist? Like,
because
it'd
probably
be that.
Timothy Chalamet now.
You could get the old, what's that dude called?
Gene Wilder.
Yeah.
Yeah, but he's dead.
No, but you could do like in that style. Like, I don't know. Either way, a Chocolate Factory game. I know they're doing Haunted Chocolatier, the game that's coming up from Eric Baroni. That's his follow-up to Stardew Valley as a Chocolatier game. But that's going to be sometime next year. Anyway, the whole Xbox thing. No, I don't think they've done enough. But I think it depends on the optics of what people want from their consoles. If you just want a monthly rollout of stuff, a curated selection of stuff for a good price, then you can get a Series S and Game Pass and you're sorted. But you're not going to have those big marquee tentpole titles because they haven't got a single one.
Yeah, I mean, it's still such, like, it's still a significant investment that you're asking for people. And, like, if you already own a PS5, you're going to already be less inclined to pick up an Xbox. Like, unless you're, like, you know, proper hardcore, I want to play everything gamer person.
Which I am.
Which you are. Again, like, I thought, if the thing for me is, like, if Starfield didn't convince me to buy an Xbox, and I, as someone who deeply appreciates Bethesda's RPGs,
God, I forgot about Starfield, yeah,
then it's probably never going to happen to me. I mean, Indiana Jones potentially, but even then, I think it's one of those where I still have so many old Xbox and Xbox 360 games in my library that at some point, because my 360 is knackered, I'm going to have to get an Xbox One or a Series X to actually play those again. But nothing new is compelling me urgently to buy an Xbox.
That's hilarious because I love Starfield and I forgot to even mention it. Like, I love that. I've got over 100 hours in it. Like, me and Josh both went through it, did the podcast on it and everything. And I've got it in our Games of the Year thing that's coming out later in the year. And I do think it's a phenomenal game. Would I say you spend the console money to play it? No. Like, it's solid, but it's just solid. It's not gonna, you know, it's not gonna justify the console.
I'm still finding new stuff in Skyrim, man. It would be different if they announced tomorrow that Xbox is gonna do a big old remastered collection of Fallout 3, New Vegas, and like, for argument's sake,
we are apparently getting the Fallout 3 one.
But I would love to play New Vegas again. Right. I would adore to play
the thing that they, because I think they have a huge optics problem. I think when people think about, like, oh, what console should I get, they just default to Nintendo or PlayStation because Xbox just isn't in the conversation. They are a bit more because of all the acquisitions, but that's still not a reason to buy a console other than you can brute force the people who just want to have Call of Duty every year and be like, just pay this one fee and you'll get it when all that stuff goes across to Game Pass. But they just don't have the eyeball-turning, head-turning releases. Starfield was the nearest thing to it, but I feel like the general conversation around that game has only got more negative over time. I'm not in that conversation. I love that thing, but I totally see the issues with it.
It's just daft to me that you could literally come a point where you just basically stream all your games, like, well, not stream, you have Xbox Game Pass and you basically play on that subscription model, and then if you sack all that off, you won't actually own anything for your machine. Like, that to me is like wild.
That's their gamble for the future of the whole industry. I saw YouTube are doing streaming games now as well. Like, when you scroll down on the app, like, same as Netflix on the app.
Well, they're going to bombard you with like 15 unskippable adverts.
Another Angry Birds clone that has an advert in front of it. But yeah, the Xbox thing for me, like, having a Series X, I got one back at launch. It's like an archive system. It's kind of like how I treat my Steam Deck. It's just something I can go on to. It's like what Amazon Prime is to Netflix to me, where if I think of a movie, it's probably on the archive. It's probably on Amazon. And if I think of some sort of old game, it's probably on Xbox backwards compatible. But when I go on my library, it isn't new stuff. It's a Hi-Fi Rush isn't still installed. It's Sonic Fighters, Sonic 3. You know, it's Prince of Persia from 2009. Like, yeah.
My OG Xbox is still going strong after 20 years. Which, again,
I think it was built like a bomb shelter.
It's an indictment of how crappily made the Xbox 360 was, even though I think that is probably on merit the best library we've ever gotten in a console.
Oh, that's a big conversation.
360 for me, like, in terms of this
PlayStation
stuff
2
had,
or Super Nintendo.
But yeah, like, the OG Xbox, I mean, that is becoming my retro gaming machine. Mm-hmm. Played Scooby-Doo Unmasked the other day.
Hell yeah, you did.
Great time.
That's the thing. I love having an archive of old games, and I just wish it was some sort of service gave you that across the board. I do really shout out the Xbox's dedicated backwards compatibility team. And there are various interviews with them over the years saying just how hard it is going back to those games and making them run again. And the amount of legwork they have to do getting in touch with license holders and everything else. Like, it is incredible, but they don't front load that at all.
That's what I was going to say.
In the marketing or whatever.
If they want to make genuine ground on PlayStation in the next few years, what they need to do is they need to do what PlayStation did when it gazumped Xbox in 2013. They need to emphasize the convenience of being able to play your entire library on one machine. Mm-hmm. PlayStation isn't going to have that issue for much longer when people start forgetting about the PlayStation 3 experiences or whatever, and they really just have the PlayStation 4 library, the PlayStation 5 library. If Xbox wants to start making ground, they need to say, well, actually, you know, you as a lifetime of being a video game person, you can play most Xbox games on this console. There is no hassle. Whereas PlayStation's own, the PS3 has, like, again, crimes to answer for, man. Like, the way that thing was built, the fact that you can't, like, go back through that. That's how I would be making that argument. Anyway.
No, dude, like if they, like if I was running Xbox, maybe I'll do a video on this. I'll rant about it. If they did,
if you were Johnny Xbox.
If I was Mr. Xbox, if I was Xavier Box, I would lean entirely into the fact that they, like, you know, have the marketing that has the side by side. Like you mentioned New Vegas, you could easily have a side by side comparison because if you play that right now, the frame rate's updated, it has auto HDR, it runs better than it ever did back then. And most people, because their brain ages the game for them in the best, it remasters it for you, won't remember how that thing looked in 2011. So do the side by sides. Do that for the old games. Sell it on like the retro market. Play your childhood. Re-experience these games better than ever. Like the best version of all those old games, if they've been put through the backwards compatibility team, is on Xbox. Like easily, it just is. Outside the emulation scene or the PC scene. Yeah, they don't do anything with that. It's infuriating because it's a great reason to have an Xbox.
There is a long-term reason they should be doing this as well because gaming as a hobby is getting more expensive. Mm-hmm. If you and the way Game Pass works, obviously they have a lot of older titles on there as well, but primarily one of the big draws is that you can play Xbox exclusives on Game Pass at, you know, X hours after they launch or whatever, or when they launch.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Before we go any further, I want to talk to you about today's sponsor, Masterclass. With the amount of time we spend discussing and analyzing video games on this channel, it's always good to understand exactly how these experiences are put together. And fortunately for me, I can do just that with Masterclass. With Masterclass's streaming service, you can learn from the best to become your best, studying and growing with over 200 plus of the world's leading instructors. For me, I've been having a blast using a class on video game design by The Sims creator Will Wright to find out exactly how game mechanics are designed around player psychology, as well as learning how important playtesting is to shipping the titles that you and I both love. But it hasn't stopped there, as I've also been brushing up on my practical filmmaking skills directly from my favourite movie director, Martin Scorsese, as well as trying to get back in the cooking game with Roy Choi's amazing course on intuitive cooking. Seriously, my kitchen is a mess, but my belly has never been more grateful. For just $10 a month, an annual membership with Masterclass gets you unlimited access to courses on your phone, computer, smart TV, or even via audio-only modes. Even better, every new membership comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, and 88% of members feel that the service has made a positive impact on their lives. And to put the cherry on top of that cake, right now, What Culture Gaming listeners get an additional 15% off any annual membership at masterclass.com/gaming. That's 15% off at masterclass.com/gaming. What's that? You want it one more time? Well, that's the URL, masterclass.com/gaming. Right, now I'm going to watch Tony Hawk try to teach me how to ollie properly. I'll see you all soon.
They need to... I feel like there's a dwindling, the market shrinks the more expensive it gets. True. Because in, you know, the way of inflation, cost of living crisis, people's wages aren't catching up or whatever. The way you win this argument, the way you win the argument is to basically make it so Xbox is the easiest platform to play on, and we have the easiest, most hassle-free way of playing older titles. Yeah. And you can have them all on this one machine. Mm-hmm. PlayStation can't do that. That's the way I would be winning the argument as Xbox. Like, it's great to be investing in new experiences and new games because that's what we all want from the industry. We want new things that are great. But the way you do this to me is that you literally are like, well, no, like, even though that is a part of our experience, we're going to make it easier for you to actually have a platform to play on.
Totally. I mean, I'm the biggest advocate of new stuff. Like, the push into remakes and remasters across the board is something that makes me itch or whatever. But, like, it's because...
You don't want to get that checked out.
It motivates me. But it's one of those things where they, like you said, they should just have, you know, there's a certain level of access to an archive or to a legacy or the history of a certain medium that just should be there. We expect it with music. Like, it was a weird thing. I think I mentioned this on a different podcast. podcast when you couldn't listen to the Beatles because the Apple, not Apple, the computer company, but like Apple, the recording studio, who might be the same thing now that I think about it, didn't have the Beatles catalogs available. That was a weird thing. Music history wasn't available. And it's the same thing in gaming, or it should be. Like that stuff should just be there as a bedrock and it's not on the PlayStation side. And like you said, if they lent into that, I think it's mainly because Phil Spencer slash Xbox slash Microsoft don't want to do that style of adverts or that style of marketing because it was such a thing in the 90s and 2000s. Like the whole Sega thing, Sega does what Nintendo don't and all that kind of stuff. Like that was everywhere for the 90s
and 2000s. They're trying to be Mr. Nice Guy, aren't they? They're trying to be like, oh, Xbox is like for the gamers, man. Oh, we're gonna give Call of Duty to PlayStation for 10 years. We're so nice. We're so friendly. Mm-hmm. We couldn't possibly. Get your nails in me.
That's the thing. I'm like, I want you to, that's the whole thing with Phil Spencer is like the general approach that they've had is like everyone can play with everyone. When everyone plays, we all win. It's like, yeah, I totally get
you
it.
What it is, it's toxic kindness. it gives me a big red, it gives me the ick.
I'm kind of like, I get it. And I definitely benefit from those deals that you're making. And Game Pass is only going to become a better monthly service, providing it keeps going overall. But at the same time, like you said, get stuck in, man. Like for me, the competition in the gaming space only leads to better exclusives or better reasons to bring people to your console. The consumer benefits overall, providing they can cough up the money for the console, which is obviously the biggest part of it.
Yeah, they need to do it soon. Otherwise, in like 10 years time, the only thing people think of when they think of Xbox is that weird Transformer in the 2007 movie who transforms out on Xbox.
I was trying to think of the last like big mainstream touchstone for Xbox, and it's like Gears
Michael
4.
Bay's Transformers.
Yeah, like, back in like 15 years, 16 years ago. They've not had a win in Starfield. I would say Starfield was enough of a win, and people were talking about it. It was the game for like a week or a fortnight, but they've not had a big, oh my God, what's going on over there style thing since two generations ago. It's been ages. Yeah. So I guess no is the answer to that question. question from Sean Capdeville, who says, have you two played games that made entire genres finally click for you? I recently got Returnal and it's made me truly appreciate roguelikes for the first time. Do you have one for this? I have one for this.
Yeah, I do. I have Hades for roguelikes and Elden Ring for Souls-likes.
Those are
the two. Both. But I mean, I've spoken about them previously. Hades made me fall in love with video games again. Like, nice. It made me relearn all the kind of convenient fast food style gameplay design that I basically absorbed into my pores over like 20 years of gaming and basically made me remember it's actually, oh no, it's okay to fail. Like in a lot of games, you have a system where it's like, oh, if you fail, this means you're bad and you did something wrong. Whereas here it was like, well, no, it's not that you did something bad. It's that you actually are going to learn from this and get stronger. And that sense of like progression, accomplishment. And the same goes for Elden Ring as well. When I came to Bloodborne like 5 years ago, I instantly bounced off the intro. Like I literally was like, I can't. I was such in a headspace. I'm so used to playing Batman Arkham where I'm pulling off like 300 hit combos and like, you know,
parrying without looking
the streets or whatever. Mm-hmm. Whereas with this, it was like, oh no, I need to like do that again. And like the sense of shared discovery and everything. So yeah, Hades and Elden Ring both made roguelikes and Souls-likes kind of really.
So the Souls thing's fascinating because it's so counter to what the expected approach to difficulty is. Like, and I love that they've only doubled down on that. Elden Ring is the easiest game they've done, but I like that they baked in the solutions to that. Like, you can get more summons, you can go somewhere else and find a different enemy to fight or whatever. But I love like how they've been able to succeed because of that. Like, people do want a challenge, but like it is interesting. I did a video on it back when Sekiro first came out about the idea of video game difficulty. Like, it was an arcade thing to get more money out of you over and over again. And that just translated over to the home releases of stuff based around the rental market. It was like, you should go back and rent the game again because you haven't beat the level, but it's coded to not let you through. There was a whole thing about Nintendo Hard back in the late 80s, nearly 90s. So for me, I was like, all this stuff is stupid unless you specifically are designing a game around that. And I, like you said, I love that roguelikes were like, why not make death a mechanic and then go from there? The one I was going to throw in is XCOM. Like, I've always loved turn-based RPGs, like the Final Fantasies and that kind of stuff, JRPGs. But turn-based strategic stuff never clicked until I played XCOM. 2012, it was Enemy Within or Enemy Unknown, and then Enemy Within was the DLC follow-up. Just awesome, just so tactile, just so, you know, planning five moves ahead and like the whole love it when a plan comes together mindset. Shout out to XCOM. XCOM 2, people don't like that much and the franchise has kind of just died off. I forget the name of the dude who created it, but he went away and made another game called Phoenix Point because something
Xavier
happened with the rights.
Com.
Yeah, Mr. Xavier Comsworth. He went over and just was like, I've, I'll bring XCOM over here now because something seems to have happened with the rights and everything else. But XCOM landed the tactile side of it to me, like grid-based strategy. Like, love that.
I enjoyed Marvel's Midnight Suns for that as well. Like, yeah. I've already been a big turn-based guy, and then I played that, and I was like, well, this is fluid, this is fun, this mm-hmm. is kind of what I want from turn-based titles.
Shout out to Midnight Suns. Like, yeah. That game is so maligned, and it's so bits and pieces that you can see were, like, attempts at a different type of game, yeah. and then it came out with something else.
That game would have been so much better if it had released like 15 years ago before the MCU. Like, if that was like a title for like
In the Ultimate Alliance era.
Yes. Yeah. Then it would have hit so much different because they wouldn't have felt obligated to include the Avengers and loads of snarky MCU style dialogue. That's what kills that game for me, is like, I don't want Blade running a butt club. Like, this feels like fanfic.
It does. I like that stuff because it was just so goofy, and I'm so done with the MCU that I was like, okay, what have you guys got?
But that feels like it's MCU-y, kind of like mollifying everyone to that same snarky joke quip machine and that True. Kind of... It's like, if I'm playing a game called Midnight Suns, I want to play as the Spooky Boys. I don't want to play as Iron Man. I don't want to play as Captain America.
Right,
I want to actually play as, like, Blade, Ghost Rider. Give me more of these guys. I don't want, you know, to fanny around in, like, the Avengers space.
Yeah, I liked it as, like, a fanfic thing. But by far the biggest strength for it is the combat. Like, yes. Fire Axis are the kings. They're the dudes that made XCOM. Like, I love them changing the foundations of how that thing moves and, like, all the different environmental interactions you can do, the different ways you can chain stuff together. That game absolutely rules, especially in regards to its combat. It's so Moorish. But it's never going to get the accolades at this point anyway. Question from L4 Oliver, who says, Tears of the Kingdom or Baldur's Gate 3, and why? Baldur's Gate 3 seems to be the game that's brought gaming back, and it's 1 point higher than Tears of the Kingdom on Metacritic. Quick thoughts from you. I know you've not played either, but I want to know what your perception is.
I mean, I think from an outsider looking in, mm-hmm. looking at what people were creating with Tears of the Kingdom when that came out, and then also what Baldur's Gate 3 achieves in a storytelling and freedom level, these two games for me encapsulate everything that is unique and special about this medium. You know, they are the things that they show the boundless limitations of what we can do when we look at a game as a, you know, a chance to explore and like innovate and actually like do unique things.
Make a video game.
So honestly, like I don't think you should be looking at Metacritic to make an objective decision on this because review aggregators are stupid. But I think you can't go wrong with either. I think they're both industry leading examples of like what we, like, not that every game should be like these. You know, we want kind of a heterogeneous approach to game development or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I do think that, like, in terms of showing where the limitations are and, like, going and, like, smashing straight through them mm-hmm. and basically saying, you know, answering every question of can you do this and it be yes, mm-hmm. that is so great.
That's
so,
a really good way of crystallizing what they bring to the table. Like, I finished Baldur's Gate 3 last night. My finish time was about 65 hours-ish. Ooh. And I know that I've still got another 100 odd hours to do. Like, as soon as I finished it, I was like, I want to do another character. I want to try all these other paths that I didn't do and explore everything else. They're both phenomenal. I finished both games. Like, it's exactly what you said. It's that whole idea of there's an assumption of limitation on games right now, especially in the AAA space of like, well, we can't afford to do this other thing, or something like Red Dead Redemption 2 is a miracle video game, which it is, but it's an anomaly because only Rockstar could afford to do that. And that's also true with Baldur's Gate 3. Only Larian could afford to do that, where the Sven Vink, the guy that owns the company, is putting his own money in to get it over the finish line. And obviously Nintendo doing Tears of the Kingdom. Baldur's Gate 3, when I finished it, and I was just sitting there with the credits, you know, you just leave the credits on for a bit, just let me just have that music for a bit more. I was just sitting there going like, I'm so glad that this exists in my lifetime. Like, it's unbelievable what they've pulled off. The sheer amount of choice that you've got and experimentation. And it's what you said about like different ways that you can figure out the quests and things you want to do. And, oh, what if I try this? And they've already accounted for it and you get something really cool from it or whatever. It's Baldur's Gate 3. Like, Tears of the Kingdom for me is way too similar to Breath of the Wild. Like, it's a really cool crafting system, but it's just that game again with that bolted on for the most part. I know that people it has its fans. Baldur's Gate 3 at every turn is an, oh my God, how have they done this? Like, every single bit of it is stupidly well put together. And it looks gorgeous as well. Like, it runs beautifully. It's absolutely stunning. I've only been on PS5. But yeah, Baldur's Gate 3 is a marker for gaming, like, by far. To give it its flowers. Question from Dave Burns, who says, with Destiny 2 being nominated for Best Community Sport at the Game Awards, just after all the layoffs and controversy at Bungie recently, can you think of any other misfires with games/studios being nominated at the worst possible time?
Ooh.
We're both legends. Thank you. I remember last year's Game of the Year being hilarious because we didn't have anything and it went to It Takes Two. And It Takes Two is awesome. I love Joseph Fares, but that was not Game of the Year. Not that I could actually necessarily point it like, oh my God, it's definitely this. But at the same time, it would be more like a God of War or something.
Yeah, I mean, I can't really think of any, like, the industry at the minute it's just in such a really sad, precarious place. Mm. And it feels like every single week we're getting news of like, you know, layoffs or, you know, just other just nonsense, which is just really frustrating. I genuinely can't think of another example of like an incongruous nomination where like something as awful has been happening off the screen, whereas, you know, they're being recognized for their talents, even though they don't have a job. Like this, that's, like what we're going through right now is so unique and so bad and so frustrating. And it is kind of, it does feel weird that we're kind of, we're going to, like everyone, like people are losing their jobs towards the end of the year, which is usually a celebration regardless of the gaming sphere. You know, it's coming around the holiday season or whatever. It kind of has cast a dark cloud over these events. Like we're going to be honoring like these games and these companies, but you know, the human cost is has been reported and is there for everyone to see.
Massively. Like, yeah, I think that because of that, because of especially October, that was when like the amount of people who have been let go is now over like 6,000. I forgot what the full number is now, but it's like 6,200 and something, or maybe more than that. That should be mentioned. I think that's why the Destiny 2 thing stood out. Obviously, the community support, the way that that game's rolled out, the monetization of it over time, and the final shape DLC being a bit of a letdown for those fans and everything is like a whole thing, but it's definitely exacerbated by the context that it's in. Like, yeah, I don't think there's been that many where something similar has happened, but we've never had a year of layoffs like this before, at least not in recent memory. I think it really does stand out. It's interesting this year as well because the whole indie discussion is a thing, which I think we've mentioned on the podcast before, but like the likes of Dave the Diver being owned by a multi-billion dollar company, shouldn't really make it indie. Hilariously, Baldur's Gate 3 would be indie because it was Larian who funded it themselves after the Kickstarter stuff or crowdfunding. This year's Game Awards are weird. They're kind of weird. It's very just kind of try and have fun with it because they're not going to go back and recalibrate the categories at this point. But it's a weird one.
It's so jarring because I feel like 2023 has been a really, really good year for games.
It's been
really, really good. I've certainly like felt like I've been more interested in actively getting more like new games than I would have was in previous years or whatever. So yeah, no, it's a shame that it's coming down like this, and especially with like the example here is like a community spirit award.
Yeah, the community spirit.
That in itself is like a particularly like that because that is literally like that emphasizes the human side of game development and like, you know, community interaction and whatever, and it. Yeah, I mean, it's a huge bummer.
It would be, it'd be like Activision getting like the best wholesome award or something like that. It's like, no, I think the way that the awards have shaken out, people have immediately had issues with them, and they're rightly so. But hopefully the event itself will still be a fun celebration of games and all the trailers, etc. I feel like the Game Awards itself has morphed quite a lot over the last few years, just because of the amount of advertising deals that can be threaded throughout it. So it's whether people think of it as an awards thing or think of it as like an E3 adjacent thing where we're going in wanting trailers and reveals. Because GTA 6 is rumored to be there, which will be the only thing people talk about anyway by the time that thing's over, if that's the case.
Grand Theft Keely.
Yes, at this point, yeah. Jeff Theft
Jeff,
Auto.
Yeah, Jeff. That's the one I should have gone for. God damn it.
Grand Jeff Auto.
I had that in the front of my brain and I went for the one that didn't make any sense.
It's a close
Stupid.
Time. A question from, final couple of questions from Pinky, who says, talking about Suicide Squad, Kill the Justice League, do you think Captain Boomerang will be throwing all those sniper rifles, SMGs, and shotguns at his enemies? Big love as always, legends. You've been amazing these past few months. Well, thank you very much. Oh. Also, Casanova Frankenstein says, what I want for Christmas is Warner Brothers to stop being ridiculous. License the Nemesis engine, stop it. Stop the live service Suicide Squad. Just stop it. I'm old and I can't be dealing with this foolishness. This is from last week when we mentioned the Suicide Squad, the general discussion around that. How do you think things have settled since that gameplay stuff came out? I do feel like it's obviously the go-to response is, oh my god, this game. I don't know. I want to just see how it does. Like, I think I'm quite baffled by it at this point. I'll be amazed if it lands remotely well. But it is interesting that they've kind of changed the perception a little bit, but it still always comes with a heaping of like, okay, that looks promising, but that's probably still going to suck.
They've released two more trailers this week. Mm-hmm. One was a Harley Quinn spotlight and one was a King Shark spotlight. Mm-hmm. I basically think that they're going to work as like YouTube adverts or like TV spots, like 30 seconds long a piece or whatever, where you get like a character bio and some gameplay examples or whatever. And like every time I begin to look at the gameplay and think, this looks like it could be fun. And again, speaking as like a DC person, I would love the idea of playing with four buddies in Metropolis and like laying waste to, you know, goopy aliens or whatever. Uh-huh. Every time that happens, they pull out a stupid gun that looks like it has no recoil and no actual connection and like weight to it, and with what people are interacting with. And I get really, really upset. It's really frustrating to me that, like, again, it's the idea of you have this license, and rather than playing to the license's strengths, you have pasted a genre over it. And that, to me, is so fundamentally frustrating. Like, you look at King Shark in the comics, right? He is a big, tanky character who bites people's heads off, slices them up, rips them apart. And you look at that character, and you genuinely can tell me with a straight face, you go, okay, so what we need to give that guy is an SMG and a purple, you know, like a minigun.
Make sure he's jumping through midair most of the time.
And like, oh, look at Captain Boomerang. So he's called Captain Boomerang. Okay, so I'm getting actually like sniper rifle vibes from this guy. Like, it's just, it fundamentally just is antithetical. It stands, like, that. As much as the story may tonally lend itself well to an irreverent Suicide Squad story that we've kind of come to expect from those comics over the years, going back from like the John Ostrander run in the 80s or whatever, it's still, on a gameplay level, it's so incongruous. It does not make sense to me. And yeah. And I, again, like, I really like Rocksteady. I really hate to be down on something that they're bringing to the table.
After this long as well.
After this long. But I just fundamentally cannot get past the idea of you're making a DC villain game and you are giving them just guns. Like, Harley Quinn gun, cool. Deadshot gun, cool. Makes sense. Mm-hmm. Captain Boomerang and King Shark, what is going on here? If you introduce Deathstroke, are you just going to make him a gun guy? I mean, he uses guns, but he's kind of more known for being a martial artsy swords person. Mm-hmm. It does not make sense to me.
I'm kind of looking forward to more of the deep dives, what actually happened with this game style reports that we'll get from the Jason Schreier or Bloomberg or some people at Kotaku or Polygon or whatever. I'm more interested in that because it'll be 9 years of development by the time this thing comes out. And they went from Arkham Knight to this, and we've had layoffs. We've had people actually choosing to leave, like some studio heads.
Sefton Hill, who was like the father the founder. Of the studio, he's gone as well.
Yeah, and it's like, that's the stuff that I want to know about. I know he'll be NDA'd, he'll have signed stuff, whatever, but over time I just want to know what that pivot was like.
It's like frustrating because I know Schreier was saying the other week that people, the whole rumor for a long period of time was that Rocksteady had pitched a Superman game to Warner Brothers and that this was rejected, and Schreier has come out and said no, that it's not the case from what he's been told. Rocksteady have always been working on a Suicide Squad game, I think he said since 2017, 2016.
It's funny,
or
that's
something.
Another thing, yeah. Is just to throw that in, there's been a Suicide Squad game in production since 2013-ish,
because like, Warner Brothers Montreal were originally on it. Yeah. And you can see, well, from what looks like compelling leaks, did a video on it ages and ages ago now, before Gotham Knights and Suicide Squad Kill the Justice League were announced, where we were looking at kind of what WB Montreal had been working on. So it seems that the Suicide Squad IP has been on the forefront of WB, the company's mind.
Yes. I think they think it's their thing that the kids will love, so they just keep going with it with it.
It is very frustrating to me because I feel like it's lesser to a degree, I guess, but I remember the tonal switch between Batman Arkham City and Batman Arkham Knight was really jarring to me because, again, I'm not privy to the developmental process on those games, but I felt like when Paul Dini was not brought back for Arkham Knight, it lost kind of the storytelling focus and the momentum of where Arkham City had left the story off. I'm getting even more tonal whiplash between Arkham Knight and Suicide Squad because you ended that game, and I know that I really did not like with the whole Batman being like, I'm just Batman now.
Right.
In fact, I'm worse than Batman.
I'm the fear.
That really annoyed me. And then now you have this where he's like, actually, no, I'm Batman again. I'm part of the Justice League. It just feels like there's you're hinging this on being a new installment in the Arkhamverse. So you're aware of the prestige of the series, but you haven't made a sequel. You've made something that doesn't really even seem to fit well within that aesthetic either.
I think it's just a marketing ploy. I mean, there was that whole thing when Gotham Knights was being revealed where they danced the line of it's in, it looks like that. Gotham Knights looked more like the Arkham sequel. And they had to come out and say, like, no, it's not. It's based off the idea that Batman died from the end of Arkham Knight, but it's not the same timeline. So they sort of like wanted to have their cake and then sell you another one anyway, and be like this weird like branching path thing. But then, like I said, like, I would say that Gotham Knights aesthetically fits more with where Arkham Knight left off, whereas this thing is like hyper day glow colored, everything glows,
really
loot items.
Like, and again, we don't know if this was, Schreier did report on this like what it must have been 8 years ago now or something ridiculous about the Damian Wayne Batman game that WB Montreal were working on. That to me would have been so much better. Like it's easy to say that about things you didn't see and didn't play, speaking as a Batman person, I would much rather be playing a Damian Wayne Batman game that kind of takes inspiration from Grant Morrison's comics, which are fantastic, and maybe leaving a little bit of Batman Beyond thrown in there as well with kind of the neo-Gotham futuristic vibe, than I would this. Like, again, like a Suicide Squad are fine, but like I don't...
Like, no one's getting out of bed for Suicide Squad.
It's kind of ridiculous to me that we can... How long has it been since Superman had a game? Like, we can have, like, a AAA Suicide Squad game with, like, all the money going in behind it, and yet we're still... The last Superman game we got was, what was that, 2006's Superman Returns?
Yeah, because Rise of Apocalypse was before that.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing. Like, I would... Because the rumors for the Superman game, which, like, you know, Shreya said weren't true or whatever, was this idea of a mid-air combat system where you're fighting, you punch a dude and you chase after him, kind of like the Man of Steel sequence when he's punching Zod. And I was like, you could finally bring that to life with SSD technology and how fast cities can stream in. Maybe you'd have to make a stupid amount of landscape to be able to have those kind of fights. But the dream of, like, a Superman fighting system, like a melee fighting system that capitalizes on the amount of power behind that guy is kind of like a Dragon Ball game that would be on that scale, punching dudes through mountains or whatever the hell you want to do, mixed with the reality of the way the character's written, so you actually care about why you're punching that dude through a mountain. But that feels like it's in another realm of Rocksteady that we would ever get from them anyway. Maybe WB Montreal going forward will do something like that.
Yeah, I have no idea. I don't know how well Gotham Knights sold either.
Really well.
I mean, well, hopefully that means, you know, we're probably going to get another Wives Service game from Montreal then in that case. I don't know. I'm just... It's very weird for me. Like, Rocksteady, like, I love Rocksteady's Arkham Asylum, Arkham City. I love Montreal's Arkham Origins. Arkham Knight, which had less of the old Dini influence, I didn't really gel with as much. So I don't know if I'm just, maybe it's their approach to the DC mythos and what they see in these characters that I'm not vibing with anymore. But on a pure gameplay sense, this thing is still astounding to me. And I agree with you. I really do want to know the thought process and rationale behind why... 9 years after Arkham Knight, we are getting a Suicide Squad game. I need to know why.
I'd be fascinated by the more that can come out about how much influence David Zaslav's stuff, how much influence he has on game development, because obviously CEO of Warner Brothers, but he was the guy a couple of weeks ago saying he wants more live service stuff, if anything else, but didn't really seem to acknowledge the reality of delaying Suicide Squad a year to get around those components. They seemed like they are still in there quite a lot. And then that idea of whatever WB Montreal pivoted onto after Gotham Knights would assumedly then be a live service focused game. And then does that have, what origins does that have in the mechanics that came from Arkham? Or does it play more like Gotham Knights or whatever? Like, I feel like lots of people on the bottom of this end of the Warner Brothers pyramid are waiting for the dude at the top to make up his damn mind. And he can't because he's too busy doing $30 million tax write-offs. And I imagine that trickles down and you're trying to just get through your working day in real time, waiting for the person above to send you an email that might gut the last two weeks.
We had the rumors as well that the Wonder Woman game would be live. So I think there was a source of someone spoken out about it and saying that it's not live service.
It was
a statement. Yeah, it's not a live service title. So clearly they're conscious of the fact that this live service word has kind of got a toxic kind of connotation now. So
I just, I'll call this right now and maybe I'm wrong. I think all they're doing is changing the terminology. By the time it comes out, it'll still have premium currencies. It'll still have regular seasonal updates and whatever for Suicide Squad. They've already said multiple seasons of content, but they'll call it something else. I think that's why they're able to say Wonder Woman's not a live service game, because they'll call it something else. They'll call it a living game or whatever. It'll be something else. But the actual, like, machinations of what people, the over monetization, the predatory side of it, it's what Mortal Kombat 1 is. I think that'll still be the reality of what those games are, because the CEO himself is asking for it. So I would be amazed if they just release games like Arkham Asylum and City, where it's just a finished actual game. I don't think you'll get them from WB until they bottom out entirely, or Zaslav gets replaced or something. That's just my thought. I think this is a terminology thing. But anyway, that's been the Entitled Banner Podcast. EBP, UBP, the UBP. I've been Scott Taylor. That's been Ewan Parton.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And we'll catch you throughout the week. Goodbye.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.